Hello and welcome to today's episode on blockchain and financial inclusion. I'm Effie Pillarinu and I'm with my co-host Arun Krishnakumar from Rhetoric in London.
Hi, this is Arun Krishnakumar from Rhetoric in London.
Welcome, Luis Bonaventura, founder and CEO of Bloom.
Yes, thank you. Thanks, guys, for having me.
So tell us, Luis, a little bit about yourself, where you're coming from, and of course, about the core value proposition of Bloom.
Cool. Yeah, sure. So firstly, thanks so much for having me on your podcast today. I'm actually calling in from Kowloon in Hong Kong right now, but I'm not based here. I'm based in Metro Manila in the Philippines. I'm one of the two founders of a company called Bloom. And since 2015, we've been working to apply cryptocurrencies and blockchain to kind of what we like to call emerging market problems. Specifically, that's around money transfer, cross-border payments, remittances. So that's kind of the area of our primary focus, and it's been that way for about 3 years now. If you think about the promise of technologies like cryptocurrency, where you know the amount of energy it takes to move a small amount of Bitcoin from one country to another is basically the equivalent of sending an email. You would think that it would be a very, very easy technology to apply to something like the remittance problem. But as we've discovered, some of this stuff is a little complicated, right? So it's hard for your average migrant worker to just use this technology. So we've kind of dedicated our company to making it new revolution in finance more accessible to the normal person. And I can go into some details later, but that's kind of the general broad theme of Bloom as a company. We've always kind of focused on how to make this stuff accessible to the normal person.
So Luis, you are no newcomer to the space, either be it blockchain, be it remittance. And one of the things I read up on your profile is that you kind of almost coined the term remittance bits across borders. Tell us more about how you got involved in the space, because there are lots of emerging market issues out there. I mean, it's not just remittance that blockchain can solve. Why remittance?
Well, I mean, so I am from the Philippines, and a very, very large chunk of our economy kind of relies on the inflow of cross-border payments. So we do about $30 billion a year in inbound remittances, and that accounts for about 10% of our GDP. So, you know, it's by no means a small amount of our economy that's kind of reliant on, the 10, 11 million Filipinos who are living overseas and kind of working and earning money outside of the country and then kind of bringing it back in. And that's kind of a very common theme. I don't think I have any friends who don't have at least one family member who isn't working overseas. It's just a very, very common theme in the Philippines. And, you know, like we're not unique in that sense. A lot of the other countries in Southeast Asia kind of have these same challenges because, you know, for whatever reason, their job markets locally, domestically, can't support the number of households that the country has. And because of this, you have to look overseas. So the way I got into all of this was that I was actually kind of in a different startup at the time. And, you know, my startup was having a really difficult time because it was an e-commerce startup, a Philippine e-commerce startup. And it was having a lot of difficulty actually getting any payments off of the internet because, you know, we were generating some sales, but like a lot of our customers would drop off because they didn't have credit cards. Again, this is another common theme in emerging markets, you know, credit card penetration, online payments, they're not very strong, right? And as an entrepreneur, I started looking around for other possible technology solutions to get around my credit card problem. And I kind of discovered Bitcoin. And that's how I got into the space. I initially saw Bitcoin as a potential solution to the credit card payments challenge. It didn't turn out to be the case, though. You know, Bitcoin turned out to be better for other things. But that was kind of how I got started. So this was very, very early in 2014 when I first started looking into Bitcoin. And, over time, we started to realize that you could package it up and turn it into kind of a remittance solution, kind of specifically for our home market.
You know, it makes it live and very sort of true to what you're doing. I guess from what you've said, beyond the technology, you are tackling a cultural problem, if you want, or a challenge locally on how to get the people to adopt this technology, correct?
Yeah. So I think one of our first discoveries, you know, back in the early days was that, you know, customer education is hard for something like Bitcoin. So these are folks who are used to sending $100 or $200 US back home every month. They're not used to sending 0.03 Bitcoin, you know, and it's kind of a very difficult proposition for you to try to educate them to change their behavior. Very, very quickly, we decided that, you know, perhaps, teaching customers, teaching the end users how to use cryptocurrencies in the raw form, perhaps that's the wrong method. Perhaps there's another way to go about it. And eventually, the system that we came up with is a little bit more, I guess you could say, more enterprise focused. Because what we ended up doing was we started to create a remittance platform that we were giving to remittance business owners. So these are like traditional money transfer operators. They're already licensed. They're already regulated. They're compliant in whatever jurisdiction that they're doing business in. And all we're really doing is giving them these tools, either cryptocurrency settlement or some other kind of blockchain-related tool that will allow them to either make their operations a little bit more optimized or, in the best case, actually drastically reduce the cost of their services. And if the cost savings are large enough, then you can hope that they will pass those savings on to their customers. So we kind of took a different route. But you know, the end result is the same. The end users can still benefit from this stuff because at the end of the day, what matters to them is that they are paying a little bit less for each of those transactions that they're doing. But at the same time, there's no cognitive overhead. They don't have to learn a new set of behaviors in order to make this work. Instead, they're still going to the same remittance business, the same remittance agent that they've been going to, you know, every month for the last couple of years. But instead, the cost of the service has gone down. So that's kind of that's always been the strategy of the company, mostly because we've found that that's the most effective way to go about it. It's easier for people to benefit from this stuff if you don't have to kind of force them into a new set of behaviors, because that stuff takes time. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it takes a lot more time, a lot more effort, and more resources than your average startup can really muster at an early stage.
So, Luis, basically, you're running the back office operations, if you want. Bloom technology allows money transfer businesses to run the back offices. As you said, eventually they decide to change their front end and so on for their customers to be able to, whatever, benefit from the transparency or whatever it is.
Right. Yeah, that's correct. So to be very specific about it, we act as a settlement partner. Meaning that the main cost that we are able to save for the remittance business is the foreign exchange rate. So I can give you some very specific examples. When we started this company in 2015, our very first market was South Korea to Philippines. So there's not a ton of Filipinos working in South Korea. There's about 50 or 60,000 of them. So it's kind of a smallish. The consequence of being a small market is that it's also not very competitive when it comes to pricing. So the average Filipino back then was spending about 7 or 8% to send money back home. So in practical terms, if they needed to send $100 back home, it would cost them about $7 to $8 in fees, which is pretty significant, you know. And what we were able to do was we were able to work with a remittance partner in Seoul, in the capital of South Korea, who started using our systems. And because of, you know, kind of our collaboration, they were able to drop their prices to 3%. So it's greater than 50% savings for the average customer. So it was a pretty big, it was a coup, you know, it was revolutionary at the time that, you know, people were able to suddenly do exactly the same transaction, but save nearly over half of the fees that they were previously paying. And over time, so we started, I think our very, very first commercial transaction was January of 2016. And over the next 2 years, we moved a little over 100 million US in total remittance volume from that corridor. So, you know, it had pretty good take up. You know, a lot, the word of mouth was very strong. These migrant communities tend to be very tight. So, you know, if one of them has found an efficient way to send money back home, that news travels very quickly.
So how many partners do you have, such as the remittance partners that you mentioned so far?
So there's 6 remittance partners that we currently work with very actively, but our API is also open. So that means that we, you know, actually there's about 50 partners that are connected to our API, and about half a dozen of them are extremely active. So you're talking, you know, dozens to hundreds of transactions to thousands of transactions every day. The API is open to any licensed remittance entity to use, and the documentation is, you know, you can just check it out online. So it's actually quite easy for them to get started if they wanted to. At the moment, our company's strongest focus is here in Hong Kong. There's a sizable Filipino community living here. And if you look at World Bank statistics, Hong Kong to Philippines is the most fiercely competitive remittance corridor on earth. So it's, you know, if our remittance platform works here, it'll work everywhere, is kind of the main thought there. Because, like, you will not find a more competitive corridor anywhere else. I think that on a really good Sunday, you would be able to find remittance companies here who are charging less than 1% for their transaction fees. So it's really, really cutthroat over here.
So Louis, I'll take this question off the podcast if you're not comfortable, but it's more an academic question from my end. Do you not intend to disintermediate these partners out of the remittance ecosystem altogether? Isn't that the real value add?
Well, so there's a couple of different answers to that, but I think that so we tend to look at things in terms of short term and medium term. Long term is very, very fuzzy when it comes to crypto, right? It's kind of hard to tell what's going to happen 10 years from now. But between like today and 5 years from now, there are certain things that will not change. And primarily, I think the dependence of your average person on hard cash will not change. And, you know, that's for many reasons. One of those reasons is that if you are a temporary worker in a foreign country, there's this tendency to not want to use banking because you feel like your money is just going to get stuck and because you're not planning on staying there very long anyway, right? So what does that leave you? It leaves you with lots of bills, lots of paper bills in your pocket. And, you know, the primary way that these remittance agents kind of show their value is because they are a hard cash collection point. My company is a software company. We are not, we're not interested in becoming hard cash collection points. And there's always going to be value in that. It's not just, it's not just the Philippines. It's many other diaspora around the world kind of have a very, very strong dependence on hard cash. And I don't see that going away quickly. It will certainly go away at some point. It's more of a generational problem, I think, but certainly not in the next 5 years. So, I don't think of ourselves as competing with remittance companies. Our interest is in leveraging the fact that they're here, that they have physical presence, they have customer loyalty, they have brand equity. And what we want to do is kind of help supercharge their business with this new technology. That's the mission of Bloom.
Great, Luis. Between South Korea that you mentioned with the 7-8% charges and the extremely competitive Hong Kong market of 1%, what are the other areas in between where you have presence?
So we're constantly working on new corridors. I can tell you that we've got Australia up and running, a little bit of Singapore. We're trying to bootstrap a French corridor very soon, as well as Canada. So those are kind of the areas that we're currently working on. And, so part of the reason why it's a little slow is because we're kind of in this regulatory state right now where some of this stuff is not clear. Philippines has kind of figured this stuff out already. As of 2017, you can just get a license to be a crypto remittance company. So there's no question anymore that it's a legitimate central bank supported activity. That's not a question anymore in the Philippines. However, in other countries, it still is. It's still a question. So we have to be careful about where we offer our services, and we have to be cognizant and respectful of, the different laws in the different jurisdictions that we want to do business in. So, it's not just a business development challenge. It's also kind of a regulatory one where, the technology is there. We know that it works. The question is, are the regulators and the central banks of that particular country, are they going to be okay with it? That's the primary question that we have to be able to answer before we decide on which new country to enter.
Tell us a little bit about your technologies, Lua, technology that you've used, Lua's, and you've clearly scaled to decent volumes in terms of what you're doing within remittance in Asia. Mm-hmm. So what kind of technology challenges you've had to overcome to get there?
Mm-hmm. Well, I can tell you that when we started, it was a very, very simple kind of infrastructure. I mean, we were just using Bitcoin back then because, back in 2015, you didn't really have a whole lot of options. Bitcoin was basically the only game in town. Ether was just starting. A lot of these other projects were kind of all just starting around that same time. So we've become more sophisticated since then. In mid-2017, we started to move some of our operations over to the Stellar blockchain. So the Stellar blockchain is a blockchain that was made back in, I believe it was invented in 2014 and launched out of San Francisco. And the mission of this development foundation, the Stellar Development Foundation, has always been to create a blockchain meant for cross-border payments. And so kind of its main customer, they always assumed, would be non-bank financial institutions. They would all be plugged into this global network of other non-bank financial institutions. And together they would form this web of pay-in and pay-out networks all across the world. So it certainly ties in very well with Bloom's vision for the world where, we try to make the act of moving money from one jurisdiction to another, we try to make it so cheap and so efficient that it basically becomes a commodity. right? So that's kind of what we would like to do eventually. So Stellar is still kind of in its infancy, but we're very supportive of the overall mission of this particular blockchain, and that's why we're starting to move over our services. So we're what we call an anchor in the Philippines for this technology.
So you're in transition into to Stellar, or you're already on Stellar and supporting further development?
So we're already using Stellar actively right now, but not for all of our transactions. Just to for our certain proportion, our daily transactions are going through the Stellar network. Kind of the majority of it is still happening via Bitcoin, because that's kind of the, I guess that's our bread and butter operation, and that's the method that the most number of our partners are aware of and know how to use already. But eventually we will start to kind of transition as much of that stuff over to Stellar as we can, because we think that just generally speaking, long term, it's going to be more flexible and more appropriate too. The cost of a Stellar transaction is like 1/100th of a US penny, so it's so cheap that you can sometimes you can just ignore the network fees to a certain extent. Bitcoin is not so expensive anymore. You can usually do a Bitcoin transaction for 1 or 2 cents. But Stellar is just several orders of magnitude cheaper, and that's why we think that it's a better solution for what we're looking for.
So, Luis, financial inclusion for you beyond the remittance aspect of it, as a person that's thinking of the space and living in this space and dwelling in what's going on with other projects, whether they're at the protocol layer or at the app layer, how do you think of financial inclusion and what do you see going forward?
It's a really, really big and messy problem. And that's kind of why we've tried to focus on just one area of it at a time. I think that, kind of giving people just democratic access to this stuff is already going to put them on a good path. Right. So I like to use the example of the internet itself, where, back in 2000, 2001, you'd be hard pressed to say that the internet was a revolutionary medium. I'm sure many people believed that it was going to be revolutionary, but it wasn't until much later that it actually did start to change people's lives. But the one thing that it could do back then was that it was allowing people to access information that, that was just not available to them, in their own particular country. So I learned how to become a programmer by reading tutorials on the internet back in 2000, 2001. I never went to computer science school or any of those things. I actually went to art school, but I learned how to become a programmer because of the internet. So it's kind of little things like that. You tend to underestimate their effect in the short term. And I think we'll see the same thing here. My goal is to just be able to give people a way to save a little bit of money, so we're saving maybe $100 to $200, if we're lucky, $100 to $200 per person per year. And, that's not a huge amount of money, but, that $100 to $200 in savings, they could do something with that. Right. And I don't know exactly what that might be, but, that's enough to pay for a semester in public school back home. That's something. And I think it's that these kind of incremental improvements that we can really kind of do these small wins that I tend to focus on more than, the huge leaps forward, because those tend to be a little bit more painful. They take a lot of resources, but I think that we're already seeing a little bit here and there. And it's all about just kind of focusing on, just being sustainable, being consistent, being not just a paper product, but something that people can actually reliably use day in and day out. And that's kind of that's the sweaty, messy part of entrepreneurship. And it's not very sexy, but that's how you can really make a difference, I think.
Thank you. Thank you, Louis. You already mentioned and shared with us that you come from an artistic background, and I've been following your cartoon work since I'm personally an aficionado. I lived in Montreal, in the city of the big, cartoon publishing companies. And I was looking today at your Black Panther cartoon, which is really sort of cynical about the race or the in to get the top spot of Cryptoland. So tell us about that aspect of your personality. Sure.
Yeah, so the art for me was always kind of an outlet more than anything else. As I said, I've been in the crypto space for a number of years now, and you know, I do have some opinions about this stuff, but at the same time, I wanted to kind of express those opinions just in a different way, right? You know, people get angry on Twitter a lot, and some other people will kind of like post some very kind of inflammatory things on places like Reddit or maybe in their blogs. So my method is just the art. And I tend to try to focus on the things that are funny or maybe a little bit more lighthearted. But I do have an opinion about these things. And kind of interestingly enough, this really took off about 6 to 8 months ago. I think that more people in the industry now know me because of the artwork. So this is all on CryptoPop.net. I think more people in the industry now know me because of the art than because of anything that we're doing with the crypto remittance business. And granted, the crypto remittance business is relevant to a small subset of the industry, whereas the art is kind of, it's a little bit more accessible. And I think that, you know, if I can make some people laugh about this stuff, then I think that you're already one step ahead. Entertain people, but at the same time, try to make them think about what the art is saying. Very recently, I started to get into this shtick where I would draw these portraits of these people in the industry that I thought were doing important things. It's funny because, you know, we know the names of all of these people. We know the name of the founder of Ethereum or the founder of Stellar or whatever, but most people don't know what they look like. So I thought it would be interesting to kind of you do stuff like this to kind of highlight that these are people. You know, granted, they're sometimes they feel larger than life, and I certainly portray them with a kind of sci-fi or fantasy kind of feel because it's kind of fun to do it that way. But I think that it's cool that you can kind of, it gives you a different perspective on things when you actually put a face on some of these names that, you know, people write about or talk about all the time.
Great. So, Louis, I understand coconut-based drinks are quite famous in Philippines. I mean, some of my friends there are big fans of that. Okay. So what's your favorite drink, indigenous?
My favorite drink. Wow, okay. So I can't say that I'm much of a fruit juice type person. I'm not super into the sugary stuff. We do have quite a lot of kind of local wines. Honestly, the first thing that popped into my head was, you know, the coffee beans that are harvested in one of our mountain regions. I like those. I can't say I'm at a loss to give you a specific thing. I'm a whiskey drinker, but that's not indigenous to the Philippines, unfortunately.
Sure. It's been very nice talking to you and understanding the Asian market and the remittance space within Asia. And have a nice day.
Before you drop out, are you actually coming to Switzerland next month or not?
I'm trying to figure that out because I'm actually speaking in Miami and then after that in Chile.
Okay.
So it's kind of it's a bit tight. So I'm trying to figure that out. I'd really love to be able to go though. And that's still kind of high on my list of year-ender priorities. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Good enough. Great talking to you, Louis. Okay.
Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks, Luke.